Good morning, listeners. Welcome to today's Healthy Community. Today's Healthy Community aims at increasing health literacy and improving population health by offering information and welcoming guests who can share their experience in a rapidly changing healthcare environment. Today we have Dr. Barbara McEnany, who is the president-elect of the American Medical Association, and she has done amazing work here in the state for the residents of New Mexico and has a long history of contributing both statewide and nationally to the health of people in this country. I'd like to offer a little information on Dr. McEnany. She is a renowned oncologist from Albuquerque, New Mexico. She's the president-elect of the American Medical Association, and her term as president begins in June of 2018. Dr. McEnany is a highly respected leader in her home state and nationally, practicing physician, a successful businesswoman, and the co-founder and CEO of a multidisciplinary oncology practice, the New Mexico Oncology Hematology Consultants Group. She's built and manages the New Mexico Cancer Center, which provides comprehensive outpatient medical and radiation oncology care and imaging in underserved communities across New Mexico. Dr. McEnany is a Minnesota native, a decorated graduate of the University of Minnesota and the University of Iowa College of Medicine. It is my great honor and pleasure to introduce Dr. Barbara McEnany.
It's a great honor for me to have been asked to do this radio program. Thank you very much.
So I think we should just jump right in. And you know, I know there's a lot going on at the American Medical Association, and they have lots of goals to improve the health both in the state of New Mexico and around the country. I'd like to get some feedback from you on what some of those goals might be and how it can support health literacy and population health.
Health literacy is the term that we use for having people have the ability and the understanding to understand the choices about their health care, what affects their health care, make good choices, but also understanding insurance and health care gets paid and what their processes are with that. We try to help patients make the best decisions for themselves. We need to make sure that the information that we are giving to patients is information that's A, what they want to hear, and B, presented without jargon and medical language that confuses everybody. And we're also trying to work with the insurance companies to say they need to provide information in a way that's understandable, because anyone who's read a bill figures out pretty quickly that these are incredibly confusing, and we worry that they're intentionally confusing.
I believe sometimes they are, yeah.
One of the things that the AMA has known for a long time is that people who don't really understand how their own health works are going to have a lot more difficulty just managing their own health. They may have negative outcomes to things. If you don't know, for example, that screening for colon cancer can actually prevent colon cancer, then why would you sign up for a colonoscopy or any of the other screening tests that are out there? So that's part of health literacy, knowing what can actually make you a healthier person, and then how do you get that service for yourself?
Yeah, and I was looking through some information from some of our government websites about health literacy, and there seems to be a lot of factors that can affect someone's health and their ability to receive information and use that to keep themselves well and have a great quality of life. Some of the things that they lay out and talk about is just knowledge of basic health topics, how to communicate with your healthcare professional. Navigating the healthcare system, as you said, can be very complicated, including filling out complex forms, locating providers and services, the importance of sharing information with your provider and how providers can work together for comprehensive healthcare and better outcomes, how to engage in self-care and chronic disease management in partnership with your healthcare providers. And I know that here in our state, 32 of our 33 counties are considered rural and frontier communities. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the demographics of rural and frontier communities and how it affects health and how those challenges in understanding healthcare and having health literacy can become more complicated and complex residing in a rural and frontier community as opposed to, for instance, living in a city.
Well, I think when you have a greater density of population, there's just more people pushed together in one area like there is in a city, then you're going to have more options, more physicians, more programs, more clinics that you can go to. So about 90% of the money that we spend in this country on healthcare is to manage chronic diseases. You know, it's not the acute illness of getting the flu that scares everybody. It's when you have diabetes and you know that it can be a life-threatening event if you don't take care of it properly. If you have high blood pressure and you're not getting treated for it, we call that the silent killer because people don't feel it until they have that heart attack and that stroke. So educational efforts tend to get pushed towards large population centers. The internet helps with that a little bit, but still there's a lot of misinformation on the internet, so it's a problematic source. But in rural areas, people get their health information from their doctors, hopefully, from other nurses and relatives and people that they know. And that's actually where people get their information anywhere. That's how we all are as human beings. The problem is that if your friends and relatives don't have the right answer and they tell you something that isn't actually correct, then you go down a path of being misinformed as well. And one of the things the AMA is working on is we call it improving health outcomes. One of the biggest problems for Americans is that a large number of us have pre-diabetes. We know that there's something like 85 million diabetics, and there's probably about half that many more who are pre-diabetic. This is a great example of a disease where health literacy can make a huge difference. Because if you see your primary care doctor every other month, six times a year, and you see them maybe for half an hour each time, that can give you a little bit of information about how to manage your diabetes. But the rest of the time in your life, you are making selections about what you're going to eat for lunch. You're going to make selections about what you buy at the grocery store and if you exercise, and if so, what exercise are you doing? And diabetes is a great example of a lifestyle disease, that there are a lot of pre-diabetics who could stop being pre-diabetic and never turn into full diabetics if they made some important lifestyle changes. So physicians, nurses, other healthcare clinicians can only do so much. What our job is for that is to educate the patients so that each of us, when we are a patient, can make those right decisions. So the AMA is also working on, and if you check out our website, you'll see some of it, we're working on teaching patients a quick six-question test to see if you are a pre-diabetic. And we're partnering with a lot of groups like YMCAs and fitness centers and school gyms and other things to try to provide a way for people to take control of their own life and their own health and go from being pre-diabetic back to being normal. You'll live longer and you'll live better and have fewer complications. The same thing with blood pressure. We know that 35 million Americans have high blood pressure. The problem is that many of them don't know it, and some of the people who are actually getting treated for this don't have adequate blood pressure control. And if your blood pressure shoots up every time you get angry or excited or something else happens, that takes a toll on the little blood vessels of your heart and your brain, and leads people towards strokes and heart attacks. So we are trying very hard to prevent that from occurring by giving people the information to be able to manage their own health. We know that when patients understand their diseases and they understand the options to control their diseases, they do or prevent things, they do a whole lot better than if they don't understand those things. So I consider doctors to be educators for the most part.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine, you know, when we talk about comprehensive health care, those medical doctors and advanced level practitioners that are on the front lines and the patients can benefit from other really important support staff, case managers, dietitians, social workers, to all come together and help educate both the patient and their families and those close to them on how to take care of themselves and what their choices are.
Exactly. No one member of the healthcare team can do this alone. The patient has to first think of themselves as a member of their own healthcare team and the person who's in charge of their healthcare team. For example, if you are diabetic, everything you eat is so important. You don't ever get a vacation from being diabetic. You can't say, this week I'm not going to be diabetic, I'm going to eat whatever I want. It really just doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
So learning about good food choices is something that is very important. So diabetic nurse educators and dietitians are crucial in helping patients understand what the choices are they need to make, what will keep them healthy and away from complications and out of the hospital and living a better quality of life. So we know, just from human nature, all of us learn better when we've heard something more than once. You know, if you just hear it once, you might remember it, you might not. But if you hear it frequently from lots of different people and you hear it in different ways, then you will improve your, quote, health literacy, unquote. You will improve your understanding of your disease and of the diseases that run in your family that you'd like to not have, and you can really manage your own care a lot better. So having people learn these things from everybody they can possibly learn it from is great. And I would encourage patients who have spent time with a diabetic nurse educator or a dietitian or gotten some instructions from their primary care doctor's office, share that. Share that information with the people you love. Share it with your next door neighbors, whether you love them or not. Share it with anybody else that you think might benefit, because we all learn better when we hear something multiple times from multiple sources.
Yeah, and sometimes it's presented in different ways from these sources and kind of underscores the basic message, but also helps people have an opportunity to think about the information. Dr. McAneam, we're going to take one break and we're going to come back and continue this very fascinating conversation. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Today's Healthy Community. Today we have the great honor of having Dr. Barbara McAneam, the president-elect of the National American Medical Association, and she's here talking today about what the American Medical Association is doing to support health in this country and across the state of New Mexico, and how we can support people in having better health and better quality of life. So welcome back, Dr. McAneam. I think we were talking about having a team approach, including the patient, of course, in comprehensive health care and wellness and how people are taken care of and what their choices are. Can you continue some thoughts on some of the things that the American Medical Association is doing, what some focuses are, and how people and patients can get directly involved in their care?
Yes. I think, first of all, healthcare is not something that other people do to you. It needs to be something that you do for yourself. I think that's key. And the doctors, nurses, dietitians, and other professional healthcare workers are resources that a patient can choose to use or choose not to use in order to make themselves healthier. So if we look at ourselves from the health professions in that way, then we, I think, move a little better to meeting patients where they are and helping them make those decisions. One of the things that the AMA is working on very hard is the opioid overdose. It's just a terrible number of people, 91 people every day die from opioid overdose. That's an epidemic. If we had an infectious disease, if Zika came over and was killing 91 people a day, we'd have a huge national outcry. It would be an emergency. We would rally resources and work on this. But this opioid epidemic has crept up on us. And so the AMA created an opioid task force because physicians prescribe opioids. And we are going to have to start with some of our own behavior as physicians to try to help our patients not get addicted to these dangerous drugs. It's heartbreaking when someone survives a bad car accident or survives a tough medical procedure and then ends up dying of opioid overdose.
Yeah.
And so this all kind of started back when the Joint Commission of Hospital Accreditation decided that pain was a vital sign and that we should reduce everyone's pain 100%. No one should ever have any pain. Well, that's not a goal that anybody can achieve. And when we gave people opioids trying to respond to that demand from the hospital accreditation body, then doctors got in the habit of being more and more and more generous with opioid prescriptions. So if you sprain your ankle, you don't need 30 oxycodones. Mm-hmm. You may need just a tiny dose of something to get you through the next day or two. We don't want our patients to hurt, but then when there's the extra 28 of those pills you didn't use sitting on your drug counters in your medicine cabinets, it's a temptation for other people who don't really need those medicines to get hold of them and use them. And if you use them long enough, they are addictive. So what we are doing from the AMA standpoint, first is to educate doctors. We got the Joint Commission to remove pain as a vital sign so that we'd stop teaching young doctors and hospitals to give people so much medicine. Here in New Mexico, last year, doctors prescribed 120,000 fewer opioid doses than we did the year before. We're beating the national average on that, and that is very good. So that's the start. You give people a realistic amount of medicine for their pain so they're not uncomfortable, but you recognize that life is never going to be pain-free. We are working to try to have medical schools train residents and young doctors in addiction medicine, because here in New Mexico, we still have a lot of people who are addicted. Our university does not have an addiction medicine program. I personally think that it should. This is one of the needs of the state, and our tax-supported university should supply the doctors that are trained to address one of the major problems that we're focusing here in New Mexico. We need to be able to have the overdose prevention drug naloxone out on the street, and the AMA is endorsing that this should just be available so that if someone does overdose, we have easy access, you know, on the ambulance services, et cetera, to make that available right now before someone dies of that overdose. But what patients can do is to have safe storage. Lock those drugs up so that you keep them away from your kids, your grandkids, the next door neighbor kids, whoever you're worried about, so that they are locked up. And if you don't need them, destroy them. We don't want people to flush them into the water supply, but if you bring them back to your physician or to hospitals, they have a way to dispose of unwanted medicines. We need to be able to do that. And if someone does become addicted, we know it happens. These are highly addictive drugs, even though when they were invented, everybody was hoping that they would not be. We've now learned that they are. And so if through no fault of someone's self, just you took the pain medicines after you had a heart bypass surgery or some other painful procedure, and you end up getting addicted, we've got to get rid of the stigma of that and say, this is a complication of the treatment. Now we have to deal with that. We've got to get you so that you are no longer addicted and you can get back to your normal life. Having said that, I'm a cancer doctor, and I don't want laws that say I can only prescribe, 2 days worth of medicine or something, because I don't want my cancer patients who have chronic disease, that chronic pain that requires these strong pain medicines, I want them to have access to them. I don't want them to be penalized and kept from being able to live their life in as much comfort as I can get them. But for back sprains, for twisted ankles, minor procedures, the dental extractions, things like that, we really have to use these drugs with extreme caution. So this is a great example of something where doctors and patients can work together. We can learn as doctors to prescribe smaller amounts, to use these drugs very carefully, and patients can learn to lock them up, put the medicines away where they can't be reached, bring them back to the doctor if you have extra medicine that you're not going to need so that it can be destroyed and not end up causing addiction in someone you love.
Yeah.
This is a very important thing. And it's rural as well as urban. This is not an inner city problem. This is a problem everywhere in the country, including in our communities.
Yeah. When we talk about pain management, regardless of the condition that the patient has, the procedure that they underwent, when we think about the opioid overdose epidemic and the host of problems that this has brought on, I think there's a time and a place for everything. And I think that there's definitely a time and a place under which opioids can be very beneficial for a patient.
Oh, absolutely.
But when we talk about the patient being involved in their own healthcare team to look at outcomes and their quality of life, this underscores the importance of patients continuing to be in clear communication and regular communication with their healthcare team to see where they're at, how they're doing. Is it time to reduce the amount of opioids that they might be taking? Are they taking it properly? Are there other alternatives at whatever stage they're in their recovery and healing, to determine what the next steps are and to make sure that their healthcare provider team is aware of that stage and what's going to best serve them?
Yes. Another area where the AMA has been very active since fall of 2016 is looking at drug pricing. I had a patient give me yesterday a tube of a steroid cream that they had been prescribed, that the bill for this was $8,000. Mm. She was shocked. I was shocked. Her dermatologist who wrote the prescription was shocked. And what we're finding is that a lot of drug prices are just escalating, and sometimes for no good reason. One of the things we found in our task force is that sometimes people who are just business people, not medical people, will buy up a company that's making a drug that's an old drug, a generic drug, but they find ones that have limited numbers of factories still making it. They buy those factories and then they control the supply. And then they can jack the price way up. That's what happened with the EpiPens that made the paper.
Mm-hmm.
That somebody just bought the only company and said, I've got the market cornered, I've got a monopoly, and I'm going to charge you an arm and a leg to get these medicines. And those are life-saving medicines. So one of the things that the AMA has set up is we have a website we call Truth in RX. RX being the shorthand for prescribing, .org. So truthinrx.org. And we're trying to have drug transparency so that we know what people are actually paying and we can follow the money back and figure out why is this drug suddenly so expensive. Drugs that were incredibly inexpensive years ago. In the cancer arena, cytoxins is an old chemotherapy. It's generic, it's off patent, it's inexpensive to make, and all of a sudden it's really expensive. We need to study this.
There's so much we can talk about, and there's so much to study and so many ways to help people in our communities and around the state in finding better health care and better quality of life. Dr. McEnany, we're going to have to wrap up this show, but I'd like to continue maybe with another episode when you have time. There's a host of things I would just love to talk to you about. And I want to thank you again, Dr. McEnany, for coming. I would encourage listeners to visit the American Medical Association website. Today's Healthy Community also has a website. We'll give you further information on that. And we'll have podcasts from our show that you can download and listen to again. Dr. McEnany, I want to thank you for your time and all the good work you're doing through the state of New Mexico and around the country. And I hope you have a great rest of the week. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for asking me. And thank you to everyone who's listening to this. I hope it was useful.
Thank you for joining us on today's Healthy Community. Again, my name is Rebecca Van Ness. I'm your host. Our show will air weekly on Fridays at 12 o'clock. Thank you, Justin Blanton, for producing this show. And if you have questions or you'd like to hear about more topics on healthcare, we'll provide you with information moving forward on how you can reach us and offer your thoughts and questions. Have a great healthy day and a great healthy life, and we'll see you next week.